Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hello, my name's David Runciman, and this is Past, Present, Future. We have reached episode 3 in my series of conversations with the historian Gary Gerstel about the ideas behind American presidential elections. And today we have reached what is perhaps the most significant election of them all. 1860, the one that precipitated the Civil War. How did Abraham Lincoln manage to win that election, and what might have happened if he hadn't? Past, Present, Future is brought to you in partnership with the London Review of Books. You can subscribe at a special rate if you just go to lrb.me/ppf. That's lrb.me/ppf. We've reached the election that you could say, Gary, is the pivotal election in the history of the Republic. The election of 1860, it has a number of unique features, not least what came immediately after it. But it's also the one election, maybe the only one, where a system that is geared to having two parties, and when the parties become entrenched, I mean, they're much more entrenched now than they were then, but when the parties become entrenched, it's hard to shift them. In 1828, we were talking about the breakup of a party system that had reached the end of the road. Parties were so divided that they had to reform in new ways. But in this election, we're talking about a party that was created just a few years before and won. So essentially a third party coming through, a new party being created outside the existing system. Its name was the Republican Party. It is still called the Republican Party. And it managed to win this election with its candidate, Abraham Lincoln. So we're going to come on to how Lincoln got the candidacy, which is a story in itself. But the Republican Party was created to fight this election on a platform that turned on the question of slavery and specifically the Western expansion of slavery. So can you just give us a sense of where the Republican Party placed itself within the existing political landscape in order to establish itself as what was going to become one of the two dominant parties? How did it make that pivot? Because we've been talking about third parties that were special issue parties, the anti-Masonic party, the Prohibition party. The Republican Party is the one third party that becomes one of the two main parties. How did they do it?
The central issue of the Republican Party has to do with the future of slavery in the United States. And the Republican Party was committed to the proposition that slavery was not a workable system for the American Republic. There were different kinds of Republicans who approached the issue of slavery in different ways. There were those who found slavery abominable simply from a moral point of view and wanted emancipation of the slaves. And there were others who were more concerned about the effect of a slave system on free labor in America. And they clung to aspects of the Jeffersonian dream that this was to be an agrarian nation of independent farmers using their free labor to build their families, their households, and a prosperous economy. Those Republicans were less concerned about the welfare of the enslaved themselves, and more concerned about the contaminating effects of a slave system on a country aspiring to a free labor ideal. There were other elements to the Republican Party that converged at various points: belief in a strong central government to develop the economy was something that was very important. Elements came out of the Know-Nothing Party, which was a nativist party of the 1850s, a hostility toward immigration. There was a moral tone to the Republican Party that expressed itself not simply in regard to slavery, but morality, religion, who had the capacity to be good Americans. So there were other elements, both moral and economic, to the Republican Party, but its reason for being was the conviction that the country could not continue into the future with a slave system that was bent on expansion and having a prominent place in American society and politics.
Before we come back to slavery, that moral question. So this new party, it had a series of, as you call them, moral positions. But this is in an era where there was a clear political division of labor between the federal government and the states. And at the state level, there was a lot of highly moralized politics. You've written extensively about this. So through the 19th century, particularly in the first half of the 19th century, which state you lived in made a big difference to questions like who you could marry, what kind of sex you could have, your relationship to alcohol, all sorts of things. That wasn't a federal government business. The federal government had a fairly narrow remit, and it wasn't a moral remit. The Republican Party is a national party or a would-be national party of federal government. Is it thinking of moralizing the federal government? Is that part of what's going on here?
Elements of the Republican Party definitely wanted to moralize the central government. The campaign for morality, it was felt, could not be left simply to local governments, state governments, that there were some issues that had to be dealt with at the level of the central government. And immigration was one of them. That obviously fell within federal jurisdiction from the get-go. But that's an example of designing a population that was capable of enjoying the privileges that America, under the best circumstances, made available to its people. So the Republican Party carries elements of morality, and it should be said, it is a Protestant morality, and the Republican Party, in a sense, becomes a more important vehicle as the presence of Irish immigrants in the country becomes more pronounced, and there's a huge influx of Irish immigrants in the 1840s as a result of the Irish famine. They are overwhelmingly Roman Catholic, and they encounter the Republican Party as an agency of oppression because they are telling Catholics how to live, what Bibles can be used in schools, what relationship they should have to their own religion and the Pope, what liberty-loving Americans should value and what they should jettison. And the Irish, as a result, overwhelmingly feel that they do not have a place in the Republican Party and belong in the Democratic Party, which, ironically, given its commitment to slavery, is much less intent on reforming the masses towards some Protestant ideal.
So the challenge for the Republican Party is to build a coalition. This is the challenge for all parties in a national system. You can't win as a single-issue party, whatever the issue, even if the issue is slavery. And the coalition is a complicated coalition. So like you say, it includes elements of some of these minor parties, the Know-Nothings. The anti-Masonic Party was swept up in the Republican Party. So there is that, let's call it that paranoid streak rather than conspiracy theory streak. But both the Know-Nothings and the anti-Masonic Party were organized around the idea of plots against America. It had to gather together the people who had fallen under the heading of the Whigs. As you say, it had to combine an agrarian vision with Northern industrial powerhouse politics. But it did face this huge barrier, which is the South looked more united. And then the South, as you say, was able, its political representation was able to draw on some sympathy from new immigrants in the North. So the Republican Party is basically a minority party. Its coalition is still not really big enough to win nationally, yet it does win this election. And it seems to me there are two reasons why it wins this election. One is because the Democrats were divided. And the other is it probably in the end did choose the right candidate, Abraham Lincoln. So let's do the second first, because there is a real question here about how Lincoln got the nomination. And this is a unique election because a third party breaks through. There really isn't a comparable election, certainly not since. But it has a feature which is familiar now, but wasn't true of 1828, wasn't true of 1800, which is parties chose their candidates through these events, and they really were events, called nominating conventions. And the Republican convention happened in Illinois, in Chicago, the home state of Abraham Lincoln. And it was quite an event. And Lincoln was not the favorite going into that convention, but he had established a real name for himself through his debates with Stephen Douglas and then a celebrated speech that he gave early in 1860 called the Cooper Union Address, in which he tried to characterize the essence of the Republican position on which this election was going to be forced. And it was, in part, it was a long speech, again, very worth reading. It was in part addressed to the South and not addressed to voters in the South trying to persuade them to vote Republican, but it was addressed to the South in order to persuade that coalition to hold together in the North. And it could be characterized within the Republican spectrum as a moderate position. You may disagree with me on this. There were certainly people who were more extreme in their vehement opposition to slavery. There are also people who were more conciliatory to the South. And Lincoln is, I think, somewhere in the middle. So how would you characterize, before we get on to how he captured the nomination at the convention, how would you characterize what Lincoln's position was in this spectrum of Republican opinion that had to be held together if they were going to have any chance of winning the election? Was he in the middle? And does the Cooper Union speech give you that sense of what it was about his approach that in the end won the day?
He is in the middle. He's a moderate Republican, very deliberately so, because he feels he has to be a moderate Republican in order to carry the Republican Party in the North to presidential victory. There's not much hope that they'll have any support in the South, so it remains a regional party.
And so it has to have the biggest possible constituency in its region.
Yes, because the North is itself divided between those who are opposed to slavery in every form, including as it currently existed in the South. And there were those Republicans who were willing to tolerate slavery in the South as long as there would be no expansion into the territories and the states that were forming out of it. And Lincoln belongs in that second camp. The Cooper Institute speech of 1860, February, is an extraordinary speech, and it has two components to it. The first part is meant to refute the leading Democratic contender for the presidency, Stephen Douglas, senator from Illinois. And it makes the point, contra Douglas, that the founding fathers, almost to a man, believed that slavery was an unfortunate set of circumstances that for a variety of reasons had occurred or been foisted in the United States, and that it was not equipped to survive and flourish across the long history that was imagined for the Republic, and that it would gradually die out, that it contained moral evils that did not belong in the present-day world. But Lincoln added, for the sake of founding this new nation and in recognition of the fact that half the colonies were slave states, that the Constitutional Convention could not undertake to eliminate slavery from those colonies becoming states, that slavery would have to be tolerated there.
But only where it already existed.
Only where it already existed. And much of the speech that Lincoln gives is a close exegesis of founding father writings and intentions, where he goes through point by point to demonstrate how many founding fathers on so many occasions imagined that slavery in America was going to die out sometime in the 19th century. What Lincoln is doing here is claiming constitutional justification for his position that slavery must not be allowed to expand beyond its current boundaries because it was not suitable for the future of the United States.
And also, crucially, that it is the federal government that decides that. It cannot be, as Douglas and others were arguing, left up to the new states at the state level to choose whether or not they should be slave states or free states. it is within the remit and the jurisdiction of the federal government. So it is an argument not just about slavery, but about what we might now call the competence of the central government to act.
They have the authority to be the deciding institution in terms of determining where slavery could go and where it could not. And at the same time, Lincoln reaffirms the other point that slavery would be allowed to continue where it was already established. And that's his way of saying that if he were to be elected president, he would make no effort to interfere with the slave regimes of the southern states. He felt this was an important message to convey, not just to the southern states, because who knew whether they would accept this, and I think he probably suspected they wouldn't. But there were an awful lot of northerners living in what was called the lower north, meaning the southern portions of Illinois, Indiana, Ohio, who lived in proximate vicinity of the slave states and of slave societies, who had in their ranks many who had been Southerners, who had families in the South. And he believed he had to find a way to bring these people on board into his coalition, so that even if his message did not work for the South, although he hoped it would, he did see it as indispensable for making sure that Republican enthusiasm in the North would be at the level to carry them to a possible victory. And this is the message that he tries to convey in a brief excerpt that I'll read from the Cooper Institute speech given in February 1860. These are Lincoln's words. "Let all who believe that our fathers who framed the government under which we live understood this question, the question of whether the federal government had the power to control slavery in federal territories, just as well, and even better than we do now, speak as they spoke and act as they acted upon it. This is all Republicans ask, all Republicans desire in relation to slavery. As those fathers marked it, so let it be again marked, as an evil not to be extended, but to be tolerated and protected only because of and so far as its actual presence among us makes that toleration and protection a necessity. Let all the guarantees those fathers gave it be not grudgingly, but fully and fairly maintained. For this, Republicans contend, and with this, so far as I know and believe, they will be content."
When I read this speech, and I compared it, because I just recently read the Nullification Proclamation by Jackson, the one that we talked about last time, the rhetoric is very different. It's much less angry. So he's confronting the South, as you say, with a message for the North in the way he's confronting the South. He's saying, thus far and no further, this is what will not stand, but this is what will be allowed. It is deliberately designed to be reasonable. But two things really stood out for me about it. One is the fact that this is, as we might now call it, an originalist interpretation. So the argument is, what did the founders really think? What did they want? What did they sign up to? What did they say? But he's turning it back on his opponents in the South because he knows that they are trying to make a claim on originalist grounds. They're trying to locate slavery in the founding of the Republic. And he, in this speech, consistently says to them, I am just saying to you what you have said you will agree with, which is you will abide by the origins of this republic. So if we can all agree that these men did not see the institution of slavery expanding outside of its pre-existing states, and certainly they wouldn't dream of allowing new states to decide for themselves how they fitted into this arrangement, you have to agree that we do have a common ground here. And then the second thing, which it does have in common with the Nullification Proclamation, is it's part of the preemptive blame game. Like, if this thing ends in bloodshed and chaos, who is responsible? And Lincoln says in this speech to the South, in a famous passage, I'm just going to paraphrase it here, but he says to his Southern opponents, you are like a highwayman who says, stand and deliver. And if you don't hand over your money and I have to kill you, you're responsible for murder. It'll be your fault. You will be the murderer because I gave you a choice. You didn't do what I told you to do, so I had to kill you. i.e. if the Union ends, the South is saying it'll be the fault of the North. And Lincoln says, you're like a highwayman who says, if you don't abide by my terrible, violent threats, you are responsible for the consequences. And that bit is furious and uncompromising. And that's the bit of the speech where it's not sort of exegesis of the origins of the Constitution. It's raw political anger. If this thing ends in bloodshed, how dare you? How dare you say, we brought it about? And that, to me, is the bit that sounds like Jackson.
I'm paraphrasing Lincoln here. I'm speaking to you as the Founding Fathers would speak to you, and I speak with their authority. So yes, it comes in the language of reason, but with a powerful fist behind it. I would also add that the reasonableness of Lincoln, and this is also an explanation for why his reasonableness didn't work very well, is against a background of mounting discord, anger, fears of insurrection, the two sides drifting further and further apart simply in the previous 3 years. The first incident that has to be mentioned is the Dred Scott Supreme Court decision of 1857, which ruled on whether slaves taken into free territory by their masters, where slavery was not allowed, could make a claim on freedom. And the answer the Supreme Court gave was no, they are property of men that belong to the slave owners. They are to be treated as private property. They're not to be treated as human beings. And then the Supreme Court Chief Justice Taney goes beyond that to say, African Americans will never be citizens of the United States. They cannot be citizens of the United States. They constitute an inferior people, incapable of being full members of the American Republic, ever. Taney should not have gone there. He thought he was taking a bold step that would resolve this issue, bring clarity to it. This inflames abolitionist sentiment in the North enormously and drives the two sections much further apart, embroils them in anger. And then in 1859 comes John Brown's attack on a federal arsenal in Harper's Ferry, Virginia. He and a band of armed men attacked. They had links with various groups of enslaved people, and they hoped to inspire a general slave insurrection. This is in 1859. Never had a chance of success. The enslaved were, in a way, too smart to join this wild attempt at insurrection. But the insurrection itself and the bloody battle that unfolded at Harper's Ferry engenders in the South their greatest fear that the enslaved will at some point rise up against them, led by crazy abolitionists of the North, like John Brown. So you have this mounting radicalism on both sides and a palpable sense that the center can no longer hold. And it is into this context that Lincoln enters his plea for reasonableness, understanding at some level that he's going to try his utmost to do that, but also being the sagacious, shrewd politician that he was, probably understanding that it probably was not going to work. But he did want to make an effort to pose as someone who, even though he considered slavery to be a moral evil, would respect the South as it was given life by the Founding Fathers. So these are tremulous, frightening times on both sides. And because I think he did not expect much support in the South, his message of reasonableness is an effort to keep whites of the lower North on board his coalition.
When you put it like that, it is surprising that he won, because he's got two barriers to overcome here. Yes, he's somewhere in the middle of Republican politics, the spectrum of Republican politics that runs from sympathizers with the South through to furious abolitionists. And just as the North and South were moving further apart, also passions were running high in the North. It's hard to be in the middle. And it didn't look, coming into the convention, as though he had majority support. There was a preferred candidate, it looked like, who was William Seward, who comes out of, actually, originally the Anti-Masonic Party. I believe the first party he belonged to was the Anti-Masonic Party. He was more of a nativist than Lincoln was. And he was also, in some ways, more of a hardliner than Lincoln was. And he looked like he was much better placed to capture the anger that there was. But Lincoln beat him. And then the second challenge he has to overcome is this new party, the Republican Party, is never going to win a majority of the national vote. It's, you know, the path to victory electorally is really complicated. It's quite hard, given no votes are going to be won in the South, to get enough votes to become president. But he overcomes both of these barriers. So the first one, how does he win the nomination? And this convention was a pretty raucous, passionate affair, and they're very dramatic events. They have these great twists of fortune. You go through these votes. In the first vote, Seward was way ahead of Lincoln, and then people switched and they switched. And to his amazement, Seward thought he was going to win, and he found that this upstart lawyer, who happened to be from Illinois, where the convention was taking place, had stolen the nomination from under his nose. So there is a reading of this, which it wasn't all the great rhetoric. It wasn't the Cooper speech. It wasn't the debates with Douglas. Lincoln was a genius. He was a genius, and he was a genius of oratory. But he won the convention through hard politicking. And he wasn't there himself. This was still the age where the candidate didn't show up in person. So it had to be done by proxy. He didn't give a speech at the convention. There wasn't some great piece of oratory that swayed the crowd.
Lincoln was always a shrewd politician. And part of his genius was not just his oratory, but his understanding of how politics work and what one would need to do to get one's name near the top. I think Lincoln was helped by two factors. One, Seward had a lot of enemies. One of the functions of having a long, successful career is that you get a lot of people angry at you at one time or another. And he had many more enemies than Lincoln, who was a relative unknown. And American politics does have a certain fondness for candidates coming out of the wilderness, unsullied by the political game, rising to the occasion, saving the republic. And Lincoln, the rail splitter, who had not held office since 1846, gave him an air of purity. He's not beholden. He can do what's necessary. And there was a sense that Seward either was beholden or had enemies that would prevent him from getting the job done. The other element that hurt Seward is that he was more militant on the slavery question than Lincoln was. He called it on numerous occasions an irrepressible conflict. So it was not simply a matter of letting the South do what the South did. He was forecasting that the conflict was irrepressible. It would come. The North would triumph. He had a record of being more confrontational. And there was worry that if he were the one nominated, that this critical portion of the North that I'm referring to as the lower North that has proximity to the South and many Southerners living there would not support him, seeing him as Northeastern, too close to the abolitionist group in the party, not trustworthy. So Lincoln benefited from the perception that, in today's parlance, further to the left on the question of abolishing slavery than Lincoln was. Lincoln didn't talk about the abolition of slavery. He talked about stopping its spread, and then the expectation was it would die. This moral evil would die of its own accord. The other element that helped him was the location of the convention in Chicago, in his home state. And if you weren't going to campaign yourself, you had to have legions of people campaigning for you. And American party practice is progressing by leaps and bounds, presidential election year by presidential election year. And his supporters were out in very large numbers. They were loud, they were boisterous, they were carnivalesque. to be successful at politics, you had to make it into a kind of public theater. It gained its character then, and it still remains public theater in America today. And the demonstrations, the celebrations, the gathering of Lincoln strategic players in a place called the Wigwam to plot strategy, they were state of the art, and they were well positioned to take advantage of a convention that they thought would open up if Seward didn't get the nomination on the first ballot. And so the goal for Lincoln, here's an example of strategic thinking, just survive the first ballot, deny Seward the nomination with the majority for the first time. Then they felt they would be able to begin to peel delegates away from Seward to the support of Lincoln. And that is exactly what happened.
Then the second barrier to be overcome is to win the general election, which he does with less than 40% of the popular vote, which again makes this election not a complete outlier. We're going to talk about another one in 1912, where you get a split set of candidates, so you don't need to win a majority of the popular vote. But nonetheless, that's low. And his opponents were different stripes of representatives of the Democratic Party. The South was more split than the North, and that's the reason why Lincoln won. If his opponents had been united against him, less than 40% of the vote is not going to get you the presidency. But the South was split, and it was split, I guess, similarly, but at the other end of the scale to the North. The radicals, the confrontationalists, the people who were not willing to compromise at any price, people who were somewhere in the middle, and then the people who were actually quite close to the North and were about defending the Union at all costs. You had Southern Unionists, you had Southerners who were spoiling for war, and you had the people in the middle. That split looks, maybe it's with hindsight, but it looks harder to bridge than the splits that Lincoln faced. The South looked more divided, and that seems to be the reason why Lincoln won. Is that fair?
I would put it slightly differently. I wouldn't say that the South was so split, even though there were different factions in the South, but that the northern part of the Democratic Party was hopelessly split from the southern part of the Democratic Party. The Democratic Party had been a national party. They had the obligation of holding together this party in the midst of this chasm that seemed to admit of no compromise. And the crucial event, I think, that doomed the Democratic Party and made this, the bridging of this chasm impossible, was the Kansas-Nebraska Act of 1854, which was put forward by Stephen Douglas, prominent member of the Democratic Party in the North, Illinois. Stephen Douglas wants to be president. He becomes senator, and which is a road to the presidency. And he's trying to figure out how, given this deep divide between the North and South, how can the Democratic Party possibly survive? He needs a formula for pleasing the North and the South in terms of westward expansion. What does he do? He proposes and gets Congress to pass the Kansas-Nebraska Act that says this about westward expansion. We, the Democratic Party, then the country, we will not prevent it. We will not encourage it. We will make whether slavery establishes itself in the new states a factor or a consequence of popular sovereignty. We will let the people decide. The people of those territories will decide whether they will be a slave state or a free state. Looks brilliant. America's all about popular sovereignty. We the people. And so Douglas thought that this would please the North and it would please the South. But he hadn't thought through the ramifications of what this piece of legislation yielded. Kansas, Nebraska are territories on the cusp of statehood. Would they be free? Would they be slave? Settlers from the South and settlers from the North are rushing into these territories. to form a majority for their region. And they understand the stakes involved, and they confront each other, go to war with each other, kill each other, so much so that Kansas becomes known as Bloody Kansas. The Kansas-Nebraska Act is an example of unintended consequences. You let the people decide what can be a more American solution, but the actual evolution of the conflict intensifies as groups from the North and the South prepare to flood into any territory on the cusp of becoming a state to make sure that that state will go in the direction they want it to go. And so the effect of the Kansas-Nebraska Act is to, in a sense, pit Northern Democrats against Southern Democrats. More and more Northern Democrats leave to join the Republican Party. And the Southern Democrats never forgive Stephen Douglas for being the architect of this act. He is the most prominent Democratic figure in 1860. He's going to get the nomination. He doesn't get it easily because Southerners walk out of his convention. They are so angry with him about allowing the possibility that new territories might become free states that they can never, under any circumstances, accept his leadership. And this is what makes the split in the Democratic Party irreparable and allows a candidate in the Republican Party who gets less than 40% of the vote to actually win the election.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
It is Douglas's position, as you've just described it there, that Lincoln was arguing against, after all, in the Cooper speech, the idea that the states could decide for themselves. He says, no, the founders were absolutely clear this is a federal government matter. So it is Douglas that he's taking on there. As you say, Northern Democrats, many of them switch and move over to the Republicans. Then you've got a sense of betrayal in the South. You still have some Southerners who do not want a civil war and will pay almost any price to avoid it. Is it also true that we've reached a point here which means we've moved away from the first part of the 19th century where if the South get their act together, they can hold the presidency, essentially? A few votes here and there in other places, but partly because of the three-fifths compromise, if that's the word for it, the demography still just about works. But at this point, the Democratic Party without some Northern element is just not enough. So even if the South had overcome the divisions that were still there between the people who were spoiling for a fight, the people who were desperate to avoid a fight, but if the South had come together, the fact that the Northern Democrats had been lost, that was enough to scupper them. I mean, I'm taking from you that actually I misdescribed this by saying it was Southern splits. A united North defeats a united South in electoral terms. The prize either goes to the person who holds their coalition together where the other splits or to the one that can reach across the divide. At this point, no one was reaching across the divide, but the South was still, in electoral terms, it was doomed at this point.
I can't identify a figure who could have held the Northern and Southern Democrats together. Perhaps if a Northerner had repudiated Douglas's doctrine of popular sovereignty and ensured the expansion of slavery into the West. That would have brought the South closer to the North. But I think the Northern Democratic voters, most of them, were not prepared to abandon the doctrine of popular sovereignty and to grant this kind of power to what was called the slave power. They were not willing to do this. This, by the way, did not make them egalitarians. It did not make them promoters of racial equality. Many Democrats, even in the North, were quite vicious racists and believed that the enslaved were not capable of free labor. But the idea that Democrats in the North should be able to travel into Western states, make it into a free state, make it into a shrine for free labor, I think any Democrat who renounced that policy would not have been embraced by Northern Democrats. So it's a long-winded way of saying I can't identify another person who could have held this party together. And it's the doom of the Democratic Party that makes Lincoln's election possible. And that renders his judgment about being a moderate that can hold the more conservative Republicans and the more radical Republicans together an extremely shrewd move, because this division of the Democrats between North and South, he understood very clearly and very precisely. And he was going to do everything in his power to widen that split.
What legitimacy did he have as president? Presumably almost none in the South. I mean, how much of this was a foregone conclusion? In the Cooper Institute speech, he more or less says, the South will not accept the election of a Republican president. And now he's laying out why that's an unreasonable position, because he is a Republican and he's a reasonable man and a reasonable politician. So they must be the unreasonable ones because they have indicated, what are they against? They're against a Republican becoming president of the United States. Then a Republican does become president of the United States. Abraham Lincoln, he's a moderate Republican. Nonetheless, is there any way in which his legitimacy as president would have been recognized in the South, or is this as the ship sailed at this point?
I believe there are six states that, as soon as Lincoln's victory becomes clear, declare their intention to secede.
So they've gone.
They haven't gone, but they're going, and the Confederacy is much larger than that. So there are these are mostly states in the Deep South, led by South Carolina. Calhoun is dead by this point, but it's his state that's leading the way, and other Deep South states. There are border states, Kentucky, Tennessee, Maryland, Delaware. Their disposition is not clear. They have plenty of unionists in them. What follows is a politics of secession, or a politics of assembling a confederacy. How big will the Confederacy be? How many of the slave states will join their forces? And there are strong elements of unionists in the South who don't want to see the country torn apart. These are in some ways the heirs of Jackson, who believe that the Union can never be dismembered. That can never be allowed to happen.
And it'll be a disgrace on those who do it.
It'll be disgrace on those who do it. So these constituencies are present in the South. And there is a moment where it looks like some possible alliance might be possible. You have a group of Democrats in the South who hate Douglas, who form a pro-slavery states' rights party, but you have another group of Southerners who form a Union Constitutionalist party. These are the heirs of Jackson. They embrace slavery, but they want the Union to survive. They run a candidate. If that candidate had allied with Lincoln, would have given Lincoln a majority. So there was theoretically a group of Southern Democrats pro-Union with the numbers, both in the popular vote and the electoral vote, to render Lincoln's victory majority. But in the circumstances of 1816, early 1861, to let cooler heads prevail was a project beyond the ability of most ordinary mortals. And the fiery abolitionists in the North had their counterparts in the South. They were called fire eaters, and they had committed to secession and an independent Confederate Republic months, in some cases years before. And in the circumstances of Lincoln's election and the South reckoning with what might confront them when Lincoln became president, the fire eaters dramatically enlarged their constituency and say, we are the future. We are the last line of defense for the Southern slave system and for the Southern way of life. You must follow us. You must join us and give us the upper hand. When you're in dire circumstances of that sort, we know from the world in which we currently inhabit, it can be very, very hard for cooler heads to prevail. So it's very difficult for me to imagine. The genie was out of the bottle, and it's hard for me to imagine a way in which it could have been stuffed back in.
One thing that can be said for the legitimacy of the Lincoln presidency is that quite soon there was a rival president, Jefferson Davis. And whatever you think about the circumstances in which Lincoln won his presidency through the convention with less than 40% of the vote, Jefferson Davis became president by nomination originally. And then there was an election in the South, and I think maybe 40 or 45,000 people voted, compared to the millions who are now voting in presidential elections. By those standards, I mean, Lincoln did at least have the advantage that past a certain point, there were two rivals claiming to be, Jefferson Davis wasn't claimed to be president of the Union, but claiming to be president of an independent country. Lincoln certainly looked like the candidate who had got it the legitimate way.
Yes, he did, but it didn't make much difference to those joining the Confederacy.
It's always struck me that what's so extraordinary about Lincoln's presidency is, for all of the reasons that those who rejected it throughout, it was contested. He had to fight for it. He had to fight midterm elections in 62. He had to get reelected in 64, which was no foregone conclusion. He had to politic all the way through. Jefferson Davis was more like a king.
And the executive power of the Confederate States was more concentrated than the executive power that Lincoln was able to wield himself during the Civil War. So it's an irony that a region privileging states' rights and local government establishes a new central government for themselves that in many respects had more power and less protection for individual freedoms.
And the man they claimed was a tyrant was constantly fighting rearguard battles just to stay in office. I want to give you one other counterfactual here. As you say, Lincoln just had to stay in the first ballot at the convention in Chicago, and then he had a pretty good chance. But that was quite iffy. So it was touch and go, and he could have been knocked out of the race very first time around. Seward could have won it. This is one of those counterfactuals where it seems to me that it wouldn't have taken a big sort of kink in the historical story to get a very different outcome. Burr as president, even though it was another very, very close election, it's quite a stretch to get Burr to the presidency. It's not such a stretch to get Seward to the presidency, especially since we know you could win it with 40% of the vote. How different would the history of the Republic have been if Lincoln had lost on that first ballot? So Seward, you say, might not have held the North together. He was a very skillful politician in his own right. He served in Lincoln's cabinet, and he was a loyal, though frustrated, servant of the Lincoln administration. He prosecuted the Civil War with zeal. But had he been president, there's presumably a chance that the thing that Lincoln's moderate position allowed him to achieve, which was to hold together the constituency, the coalition that was needed to fight this war, that would have broken apart. Is that one of those forks in the road in American history where you could get a very different world?
Well, here's a more interesting counterfactual. I'm looking at the numbers of votes that Lincoln got and that Stephen Douglas got. Lincoln got 1.9 million votes. Douglas got 1.4 million votes. The really tantalizing counterfactual is this. If Seward had won the nomination, would he have prevailed in the election?
So you think he wouldn't even have got to 40%?
He might not have. And Douglas was at 30%. could Douglas have peeled off enough conservative Republicans in the North?
In the way that Lincoln peeled off enough Northern Democrats.
Yes, to be victorious. That's really tantalizing. Then we can really imagine.
So that is a very different world where Stephen Douglas is president of the United States in 1860. What does happen then? He's no Jackson, right? So he doesn't hold the Union together. As you say, he's from Illinois. He doesn't hold the Union together that way.
He may have mollified the South by allowing Southerners to flood into the territories and also establish, after a period of violence, a bunch of slave states. So it's possible to imagine the continuation of slavery, which Douglas was prepared to tolerate, and the South may have accommodated themselves to that. In other words, there may have been a rapprochement, if Douglas had won, between himself and the Southerners, rendering the Democratic Party, at least for another 10 or 20 years, a majority party again. And keep in mind the comparison to when slavery went extinct in other societies in the New World, Cuba and Brazil, both the 1880s. So it's not impossible to imagine a form of slavery continuing in the United States for another 20 years. If Seward had won, what would have been different? Here, I think we get into questions of how would Seward have managed the war? There would have been war, so that would not have changed. The South would have been, if it's possible, even more alarmed at Seward's election as president than at Lincoln. So secession would have occurred, war would have occurred. I think to the crucial moments of transition in this North's campaign against the South, you know, for the first couple of years, the Northern armies did not do very well. The Southerners were better organized. They had better military leadership. They came within a whisker at Gettysburg of winning. And if the North had lost at that point, you know, if we go back to Lincoln, he would have lost. If he had lost to Gettysburg, he probably would have lost the 1864 election to a Northern Democrat. The question is, would Seward have prosecuted the war more or less successfully than Lincoln? Would he have come out of it the same way Lincoln did, with a victory, ultimately finding the right generals, getting enough victories to win in 1864 to give the North a chance to finish the job? Or would Seward have handled it more poorly? One could argue that a far more experienced man in political affairs than Lincoln, and I think of someone who had not held public office since 1846, suddenly not only coming into office, but confronting what some people consider to be the first total war of the modern age, having had no experience in public life, except briefly as a state representative. Would Seward have handled that situation better than Lincoln? You might argue that he would have, but it's also the case that Seward would have been faced with moments of grave crisis where the victory of the North was in doubt. I simply can't answer the question of whether he would have made the same or better decisions than Lincoln, or whether he may have avoided some of the grave moments that threatened the very existence of the Union. I can pose the question, but I can't answer it.
So let me have one more go at it, putting it slightly differently. Who knows what judgments they would have made? Lincoln made some bad judgments, and he made some great judgments, and he was a completely remarkable man, and Seward came to view him as not just a worthy president, but a remarkable president. He was the moderate. There were reluctant Republicans. There were reluctant Northerners in this war, and Lincoln managed to hold that together. There was presumably a risk that Seward's candidacy, which would have spoken more directly to the people who were more directly opposed to slavery, not just to expansion, but to slavery, but it would have alienated some of the people that Lincoln kept in the fold. And I'm just very conscious that the history of the Civil War is a precarious history. It's not just bad decisions were made and there were twists of fate. Certainly early on, the North could have lost that war. And the first job was to survive the war in order then to be able to win it. And Lincoln survived partly through skill and partly because he was the moderate Republican. I'm just wondering whether the slightly more immoderate Republican might have been unable to prosecute the war long enough to be able to win it?
Interesting question. Lincoln, the opposition to him grows in the North because the war for much of his first term is not going well. And would Seward have fared more poorly in that regard?
I guess in a war, if you win a few more battles, that can cover a multitude of sins.
Yeah, and perhaps his greater skill in public service, his greater experience in government may have made him a more effective war leader early on, choosing better generals to lead the fight. So one could analyze this in both directions. Both would be interesting to follow through to a logical conclusion. I would also say that over the course of the war, Lincoln moves closer to Seward's position. 1863 is the Emancipation Proclamation, where he declares all enslaved people in territory controlled by the secessionists are hereby free. That's a Seward position. Now, Lincoln comes to that by reason of war necessity, not by thinking I was wrong in thinking earlier that slavery should be allowed to exist in the southern states. This is a war measure. How am I going to win this war? Whenever Union armies go through southern territory, thousands and then tens of thousands of enslaved people leave their land and follow the route of the Union army as a path toward freedom. What is Lincoln going to do with all these people? Return them to conditions of enslavement? He decides to free them. And states where, which had southern states where slavery existed, like Kentucky, that had not seceded, their enslaved people remain enslaved. So he takes one step toward emancipation in 1863 or 1864, has become committed to emancipation of all enslaved people in the United States. And that's going to become the 13th Amendment to the Constitution that he sees through Congress before he's killed. So the necessity of war impels him to rethink and revise his thinking about where emancipation in the United States should occur. And by the end of his first term, he has committed himself to the emancipation of all enslaved peoples in the United States, which moves him closer to a Seward position.
It's a bit like the Andrew Jackson story, that there are only certain kinds of politicians who can make certain kinds of moves. And maybe you have to have been Lincoln in order to get ultimately to Seward's position as something that can be enacted as president. Maybe the person who couldn't have done that was Seward.
Very interesting proposition. And appropriate to connect Lincoln to Jackson, and what connects them and what distances them both from Calhoun is about the primacy of the Union and keeping the Republic together. We don't often think of Lincoln as being in part Jackson's heir, but his commitment to the Union and maintaining it, as this being the message of the Founding Fathers, that becomes his mission. That was Jackson's mission. And so in a curious way, this Republican who was so at odds with that earlier Democrat becomes the person who takes up the sentiments and convictions that Jackson expresses in the Nullification Proclamation of 1832.
Including the idea, this shame will be on you.
This shame will be on you.
If you haven't done so already, do please sign up for our new fortnightly newsletter. It's free. All you have to do is click on the link in our show description. The first edition accompanies our recent series about the great political fictions, but the next one, coming soon, will accompany the first four episodes in this series about American elections. Do also follow us on Twitter at PPF Ideas. On Sunday, in our next episode, I'm going to be talking with Gary about the election of 1896, when William Jennings Bryan, the great populist, nearly upended the whole of American politics with one speech. Do join us for that. This has been Past, Present, Future, brought to you in partnership with the London Review of Books.
Hi. Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.